Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Edward Borens, the co-owner of Garcia Street Books. And on behalf of my partner and wife, Ava, I'd like to welcome you all here and thank you very much for joining us tonight. You're going to be in for a very interesting and perhaps a bit of a scary evening, but I know you'll deal with it and wait till you start reading the book. It really is a pleasure for me to live in Santa Fe and to be a bookseller here. We really are very fortunate. We're fortunate as booksellers. Have Bart here, world-class journalist, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And I want you to know this is his first stop on a national coast-to-coast bookstore tour. So thank you very much, Bart, for accepting our invitation. And we're also fortunate because we have wonderful radio here in Santa Fe. And it really, I want to thank you, Mary Charlotte, so much. Mary Charlotte, the host of Radio Cafe in KSFR. Sometimes I think we almost take Mary Charlotte for granted. She's ubiquitous. She's everywhere. She does all these, as well as her radio, all these interviews, and she is the best. We really are very fortunate to have you here in Santa Fe, Mary Charlotte, and I thank you very much for joining us this evening, and I turn the evening over to you.
I can't walk in these shoes. Well, I'd like, first of all, to thank Edward and Ava Borens and Garcia Street Books, who are doing something which is quite amazing, which is running a thriving independent bookstore in a small city. So many large cities don't even have independent bookstores anymore, and they bring some of the best authors anywhere into Santa Fe, and I often have the good fortune to be able to speak with them and bring them to our public here on here in Santa Fe and on KSFR. And I want to thank KSFR, and George Weston is here recording this, so this event will at some point, God willing, be on the radio. And and thanks to all of you for being here. I'd like to welcome Barton Gellman, who is Special Projects Reporter for the Washington Post, covering diplomacy, the Middle East, the Pentagon, the D.C. Superior Court. Now, he won a Pulitzer Prize along with his partner Joe Becker this year for their series on Cheney. This was his second Pulitzer Prize. He's also won a George Polk Award, the Goldsmith Prize for Investigative Reporting, and more honors than I can mention here without taking time away from the reason that we're here in the first place, which is to listen to him talk about this new and amazing book, Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. I've had the privilege and pleasure to spend some time with this book over the last few days. It came out, I guess, last Monday or Tuesday. And it's just amazing to me how an author can take a person and an era of politics that is so complex and often so dry and difficult to understand and put it on the page to the point where you feel like you're reading a political thriller. And at moments, you kind of wish it were fiction. The book brings out incidents in recent history heretofore unknown by the American public or most of the American public, and that are important for their historical significance and for helping us, perhaps, we hope, toward a national conversation about how we govern ourselves and how we are governed by the people we, for lack of a better word, elect. Please welcome Barton Gellman.
Glad to see so many people come out on a Monday night. Thank you. Someone out in the lobby asked me why Angler, why that title. It's Dick Cheney's Secret Service code name. And the Secret Service has a sense of humor about these things. a lot of the times they assign a code name that has a sort of double meaning to it, or could be read that way. Cheney, of course, loves to fish, but he also gave me with this code name a nice metaphor for the way that he's operated in Washington. Mary Charlotte mentioned that this thing began as a series in the Washington Post a year and a half ago almost. I figured, well, that's 20,000 words. How hard can it be to turn it into a book? The thing is, I could not let go of the story. I'm not ashamed to say I became sort of obsessed that Cheney as my white whale. So I kept on reporting and reporting, and my publisher became more and more inclined to remind me about the deadline thing. I blew the date by almost 3 months. But I hope that'll be good news for you. Three-quarters of the book is new material, things that I did not know or did not have room to write in the paper or that hadn't happened yet. The last scene in the book, which is one of my favorites, took place just 10 weeks ago on the 4th of July. I'll just say this for the record. Don't try that at home. Publishers, it turns out, do not like to get the last chapter of a September book in July. Dick Cheney has been the most powerful and secretive person to hold that office, the nearest thing to a deputy president this country ever had. Angler does have a frame of reference. It has a point of view and a kind of authorial voice that I can't use in a daily paper. But it's not really a political book. It does not have a lot of adjectives. It's not a case for the prosecution or the defense. I'm a storyteller, and Angler's a narrative. The stories, nearly all of them are new. I just skipped the stuff mostly that was well-known, used a little bit of it as context. My intent is to tell you what really happened, which of the myths about Cheney are true, which of them aren't true, and which things you've never dreamed of before. More than tell, I try to show you. So I thought I'd offer something tonight, however, that you can't find in the book. A friend of mine, the columnist Eugene Robinson, said once that people who study public policy ought to be forced to take a course called Cheney. So that reminded me, and don't ask why exactly, of that book a few years ago on dating called The Rules. You know, How to Attract and Keep a Man, Dear Abby Meets Machiavelli. That was a big, big bestseller, so I'm perfectly happy to associate myself. What I'm going to give you tonight are Cheney rules. They're not usually spelled out in the book, but they do infuse just about every scene. So for each rule, I'm going to read a short passage that shows it at work. Rule number one, fly under the radar. The first chapter of Angler tells the story of Cheney's selection as VP. He devised just about the most intrusive system ever imposed on potential running mates. When his own name came up, Cheney did not fill out the questionnaire. So here's a passage that starts with former Vice President Dan Quayle. He went down through everybody's negatives, Quayle recalled, and everybody has negatives, and nobody really vetted him on what his negatives were. I asked Cheney's old friend David Gribben, who was vetting the other candidates, if he had looked over Cheney's records too. Gribben replied to me, no, heaven and good grief, no. No one had access to Cheney's tax or corporate records, and no one but his own doctor read a word of his medical files. I'm still reading here, so I'm going to have to look down. Cheney did not submit even his public speeches, interviews, testimony, and voting record. Dan Bartlett, then and later the top communications strategist for Bush, said Cheney set his heels against opening the books at Halliburton. He said, "We're not going to drag them in." Bartlett went to Bush and said, "We're getting our asses kicked in the media because we're not prepared." Cheney wrote it out, and Bush went along. "To his standard, he probably thinks he's an open book," Bartlett said. "To his standard, trust me." Rule number two, See rule number one, fly under the radar. Later that chapter, we find out that embarrassing information from the vetting file of one of Cheney's rivals, the Republican governor of Oklahoma, Frank Keating, is leaked to Newsweek. The version that Newsweek gets is that Keating had a skeleton in his closet. He had accepted big financial gifts and failed to disclose them. So I'm take up now with this scene. In fact, Keating had reported the gifts and cleared them with federal ethics officers, but the gifts had not become public knowledge in Oklahoma, which has no such disclosure requirement. The Newsweek story touched off an explosion in Keating's home state. The legislature launched an investigation. Scores of local stories spoke of Keating's abandonment, even by his great friend George W. Bush. By the time reporters examined the federal ethics rulings, the biggest man in Oklahoma was political roadkill, crushed under wheels he never heard coming. No one caught a clear view of the driver. Rule number three. This is related to rule number one in Keating's case. Don't screw with Cheney. Reading now. It obviously came from Dick Cheney or one of his people, Keating told me. To say that it was chicken shit, excuse the expression, is an understatement. I mean, Dick Cheney coming into my life has been like a black cloud. The story did not go unnoticed in Washington. Keating made no public accusation, not until his interview for this book, but he hinted at his suspicion among friends. The rumor spread, and Keating thereby did the vice president a favor he did not intend. He propagated the message, educational, and just deniable enough, don't cross Cheney. The town was full of important people who had handed the vice president their most personal files. John Kasich, Tom Ridge, Bill Frist, John Danforth, John Kyle, Chuck Hagel. Dick Cheney knows more about me than my mother, father, and wife, Frist told the Washington Post. Not, he added, that he was complaining or anything. Rule number four, see rule number three, don't screw with Cheney. There's a lot of examples in the book of that one. Paul O'Neill and other economic advisors, like Larry Lindsay, fought Cheney on some of his tax and spending plans. Now, there's another guy named Ed Lazier who figured out rule number four, and he got out of Cheney's way. Back to the book. It required a healthy dose of boldness for anyone at the table to press a disagreement very far. Cheney became, quote, a big time saver for us in that he takes off the table a lot of things that he knows are going to go nowhere, said Ed Lazier, who chaired the Council of Economic Advisers. Lazier, who ordinarily carried himself with the confidence of a man at the pinnacle of his profession, said he could not name a time when, quote, I have thought I was right and that the vice president was wrong. Sometimes he said, I might fight for 10 minutes or so and, you know, kind of try to argue it out with him, but it's clear by the time we've talked something through, I agree with him. I can't think of one case where he hasn't persuaded me. Rule number five, silence is powerful. If you want to understand Cheney's influence, you have to understand how much he spooks people even when he doesn't seem to be trying. Back to the book. Stephen J. Hadley, who landed the Deputy National Security Advisor job under Condoleezza Rice, was another of Cheney's defense dogs, an informal group of Pentagon alumni. Like a lot of Cheney's employees, then and since, Hadley admired the man and found him unnerving in roughly equal measure. One day at the Pentagon, where Hadley served as an assistant secretary in the early 1990s, he emerged from Cheney's office and ran into David Gribben. Once again, he had briefed his boss and received little more than an inscrutable nod in return. You know, Cheney somehow intimidates me, Hadley told Gribben. He's not trying to intimidate me, but when I'm sitting there briefing him, I'm talking a little fast and my voice is a little high. Now, just as an aside here, this is the guy who was supposed to be coordinating policy. He became, as you all know, National Security Advisor in the second term, and he was simply not going to be the guy who stood up to Cheney and said no. Rule number 6, never mind silence. Screaming is powerful. Cheney's not a screamer, but his lawyer is. This scene begins the most extended and, I believe, the most important narrative in the book. It takes up 2 full chapters, and it describes what happens after the Justice Department becomes convinced that the warrantless domestic surveillance is illegal. At least part of it is. One day, a couple of NSA lawyers drive down from Fort Meade, Maryland, where the National Security Agency is headquartered. They've heard that the Justice Department is worrying, and they've decided they want to see the opinions for themselves. A burst of ferocity stunned the room into silence. No other word for it. The vice president's attorney was shouting, "The president doesn't want this. You are not going to see the opinions. You are out of your lane." 5 government lawyers had gathered around a small conference table in the Justice Department's command center. 4 were expected. David Addington got wind of the meeting and invited himself. This was going to be a very short meeting. "It's none of your business," Addington exploded. "This is the president's program." If Brenner and Potenza, and those are the names of these NSA lawyers, if Brenner and Potenza had replied with the auditor equivalent of, "You're not the boss of me," they would have been right. The 2 men could have pressed their document request and told the big, loud man from the White House to get out of their way. But that kind of thing did not happen often to an emissary of the vice president, Addington least of all. The NSA lawyers returned to their car empty-handed. Rule number 7. When the vice president calls, pick up the phone. Very early one morning, a voicemail indicator began to blink in room 6140 of the Interior Department. Sue Ellen Wooldridge played the message when she arrived. "This is Dick Cheney. I understand that you're the person handling this Klamath situation, and I have some questions. Please call me at..." Sort of a long pause. "I guess I don't know my own number. I'm over at the White House." Yeah, right. Who would fall for that? Wooldridge, 40, was the 19th ranking official in a department that did not exactly bask in White House attention. "I thought to myself, someone is f***ing with me," Wooldridge said. She pressed star D on the keypad. Delete. Late that afternoon, Wooldridge returned from a meeting. Another message. Guy named Ron Christie from the White House, Cheney's deputy domestic policy advisor. "Any special reason," he asked, "why you're not returning the vice president's call?" "Oh, God, not a prank. Really sorry." Rule number 8, reach down. This is also illustrated by the same Wooldridge story. There are a lot more examples in the book. Cheney would find out where in the bureaucracy a decision is going to be made, the pivot point for policy, long before it reaches the White House, and go straight there. And what Cheney knew is, much of the time, it never does reach the White House, never rises to cabinet level. If you're talking to a deputy assistant secretary, an enormous number of decisions are made and done right there. Where to spend money, who to regulate, so on and so forth. Cheney not only helped pick the cabinet during the transition, and frankly dominated that process, he also was putting people like Paul Hoffman, the former head of his Casper, Wyoming congressional office, into a deputy assistant secretary's job at Interior. Rule number 9, know what you want. This is going to sound really obvious, but it's powerful. Let's say you're here with some friends and you have to pick a place to eat when you leave. No great decision of state, just pizza or Chinese. Half of you are going to be on the fence. I'm going to move to the book now. David Frum, one of Bush's speechwriters, said, quote, there was a kind of aimless quality within the first year to the president's domestic policy agenda. There was nothing aimless then or ever about Cheney. There would be many reasons for Cheney's dominance in the Bush administration, some of them quite subtle. One was as simple as could be. The vice president knew what he wanted. Unlike most of his rivals, and even the president he served, Cheney seldom indulged in ambivalence. Either he had a direction in mind, or he regarded the choice as unimportant and stepped aside. Rule number 10. Truth is like fiction. Cheney's wife Lynn is a novelist. One of her novels is more or less a guidebook to the last 8 years. Back to the book. Lynn Cheney's Executive Privilege, published in 1979, stars a heroic president from out west, Montana, not Wyoming, brisk and businesslike and principled. An entertaining subplot involves the scheming number two, angling to make the vice presidency more important. President Zern Jenner lies unapologetically to protect a foreign policy objective, which is regime change. More importantly, he says he's protecting the prerogatives of the office itself. Jenner, say it fast and it sounds a little familiar, is a barely camouflaged stand-in for Dick Cheney, a man with a famous, quote, tenacity and self-control, end quote. The plot is also a stand-in for Cheney family values. In one scene, a top aide to the president praises martial law tribunals for terrorists 22 years before the September 11th attacks. The bad guys are mostly reporters. They're disrespectful, inclined to unkempt dress and slouching demeanor. They lie, sleep with sources, and steal documents off unguarded desks. The number one villain, wait for it, writes for the Washington Post. Rule number 11, fiction is like truth, also known as you can't handle the truth. The vice president leaned over a coffee table, unrolling secret documents across the top. He had an audience of one. Dick Armey, the House Majority Leader, saw no need for a scrap with Saddam Hussein. In the privacy of his office, for this one crucial vote, Cheney leveled claims that crossed so far beyond the known universe of fact that they were simply without foundation. The vice president brought the disquieting news that Iraq's, quote, ability to miniaturize weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear, end quote, had been, quote, substantially refined since the first Gulf War, Army recalled. It was the suitcase nuke scenario, the ultimate nightmare. Why had Army not heard about this from George Tenet? According to Army, Cheney also reported that al-Qaeda was working with Saddam Hussein and members of his family. What this meant, Cheney said, was that we, quote, now know they have the ability to develop these weapons in a very portable fashion. And they have a delivery system in their relationship with organizations such as al-Qaeda. Eventually, Army learned that the CIA had no intelligence to support these claims, none at all. And I will say as an aside here that there remains some controversy over whether Cheney's public statements were misleading, dishonest, lies. He was relying in those public statements on at least pieces of intelligence. He was exaggerating the certainty. He was happy to quote things that were unknown reliability. But in this case, he's just making it up. Here's a quote from Dick Armey. If you'll pardon the Texas vernacular, I felt like I deserved better from Cheney than to be bullshitted by him. Rule number 12. This goes with rule number 3. Don't screw with the vice president. The rule is, if you're pissed off at Cheney, kick someone else. The second or third time Cheney blindsided Rice and Powell, the two of them decided to send a message. They synchronized an appearance to lodge a complaint with Al Gonzalez, the White House counsel. Powell at her side, Rice blazed with anger. "There will be no more secret opinions on international and national security law," she commanded. If it happened again, she would go straight to the president. Powell remarked admiringly as they emerged that Rice dressed down Gonzalez, quote, "in full Nurse Ratched mode." He had just compared the national security advisor to the head nurse in the 1975 film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which happened to be set, a colleague pointed out, in a mental hospital. No one believed poor Fredo was in charge of the decision to exclude Rice and Powell, but neither of them raised a ruckus with the vice president or even Addington. When it came to Cheney, Rice's voice, like Nurse Ratched's late in the movie, was choked to a whisper. Rule number 13, know thine enemy. This scene begins after Abu Ghraib. The top national security lawyer for the White House, John Bellinger, writes a very frank memo to Condi Rice, advising her that the president should publicly demand an explanation from Rumsfeld. This is a time for the president to distance himself from this and make it very clear where he stands. Cheney, Rumsfeld's old friend, does not think highly of that advice. So here's to the book. And then Bellinger found out something that, in 3 years as a top advisor to Rice, he had never known. Every time he wrote a memo to his boss, a blind copy was routed to the vice president's office. Libby, according to one official, made the arrangement with Steve Hadley, Rice's deputy. It was not advertised, and neither was it reciprocated. What happened in Cheney's office stayed in Cheney's office. Rule number 14, really know thine enemy. "How dare he? This is illegal," Eric Edelman said, looking up from a stack of stapled intelligence traffic from the National Security Agency. "He had no instructions to do that. What are we going to do about it?" Edelman was Cheney's principal deputy national security advisor. What he was reading, according to a colleague, was the NSA transcript of an American diplomat's conversation in the Persian Gulf. Richard Haass, the State Department's director of policy planning, was in Abu Dhabi. He had been battling the Pentagon and the vice president's office in a tug-of-war over engagement with Iran. Cheney and Rumsfeld backed strict isolation in order to undermine the regime. Like other senior officials, Edelman received daily transcripts from the NSA. Ordinarily, when eavesdropping on Americans abroad, the agency removed their names from the transcript. But policymakers could obtain a name by special request. The vice president's office took advantage of that prerogative. At the United Nations, U.S. diplomat Hilary Mann was authorized to speak to her Iranian counterpart, Quraish Ahmadi, about Afghan issues. One day, a friend at the State Department warned her that her meetings, too, were monitored. "Be careful," the friend warned, alluding vaguely to high-ranking figures in the White House. "Your name is coming up in intercepts. Protect yourself." Rule number 15. Winning is easy when the other side doesn't know there's a game. Cheney used to talk a lot about process, making sure decisions were carefully vetted. I got a hold of some notes that Jim Baker made when he was about to become the chief of staff to Ronald Reagan in 1980. He went and interviewed most of the former chiefs of staff, including Cheney. And there's only one place in Baker's notes where he writes in all capital letters for Cheney's emphasis. It says, "Be an honest broker. Don't use the process to impose your policy views on Prez." That's not how it worked when Cheney persuaded Bush to reverse a campaign promise to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant. Christy Whitman at EPA sensed trouble, and now I pick up with the book. Bush had said when he hired her, "If you ever need to talk to me directly, just blow away the palace guard." On Friday, 5 weeks into the job, Whitman phoned for an appointment. Bush's schedulers slotted Whitman for 10 a.m. the following Tuesday. She spent the weekend honing a set of short, sharp talking points. Cheney, who saw the president's calendar in advance, had plenty of time to preempt her. Whitman's meeting did not last long. Cheney had already been and gone, Bush's signature in hand. As a dispirited Whitman left the Oval Office, Cheney walked briskly past in an overcoat, heading for the weekly Senate Republican lunch. "Do you have it?" the vice president asked an aide, who passed him an envelope. The vice president was taking no chances. He would deliver Bush's letter by hand. By afternoon, the president of the United States had aligned himself with fringe group claims that the causes and significance of global warming remained unproved. Rule number 16, hypothetical questions aren't. This is the story of how warrantless domestic surveillance began when Cheney summoned NSA Director Michael Hayden just after September 11th. Outsiders spoke of wiretapping, but agency employees had a saying, "Outsiders don't know SIGINT from Shinola." Telephone calls were one thin slice of the electromagnetic spectrum. If information flew on a photon, the agency tried to catch it, microwave or radio wave, visible light or infrared light, or laser. Headquartered on a 5,000-acre campus at Fort Meade, Maryland, the NSA could aim its globe-spanning apparatus anywhere, in or out of U.S. territory. It could, but it did not. Cheney asked George Tenet to find out what the NSA might do differently if unleashed. Hayden came back with a Venn diagram, three ovals with overlapping edges. One oval represented the spy master's ideal, everything desirable that SIGINT might provide. A second showed what could be done with present technology. The third oval included only what was legal. The agency, Hayden told the vice president, worked inside the space where all three of those ovals intersected. The vice president looked at Hayden's three ovals, desirable, possible, legal. "Set aside the third one," Cheney said. "What could you accomplish if you stopped closing your eyes and ears to communications inside the United States?" Rule number 17, watch the boss's diet. In this story, John Ashcroft finds out that Cheney's planning to create military commissions to try terrorists. He doesn't like the idea, and he goes to see Cheney. Just as a precursor to this, Cheney essentially sent him home, said, "This is what we're doing." It was difficult to tell what the president knew, if anything, about the military order now heading toward his lunch table. Certainly he approved the idea that this was going to be a new kind of war without a lot of lawyerly coddling for terrorists. When details became important, someone was supposed to tell him. Was he aware of Ashcroft's objections? Did Bush intend to keep his national security advisor and secretary of state out of the loop? Jack Marsh, an old friend of colleague of Cheney's, said Cheney believed, quote, "you get off the president's plate everything that you can." When Cheney cared about an issue, he did what he did with barbecue. When Lynn wasn't looking, he piled his own plate high. Every administration struggled with this question. The president should not be asked to decide questions below his pay grade, but he had to know enough to decide when he wanted to intervene. Ashcroft could have walked a few yards down the hall. This meeting took place in the Roosevelt Room. He was not close to Bush, but the Attorney General got an appointment when he asked, "How many times did a cabinet officer want to dip into that well?" Ashcroft turned left at the door from the Roosevelt Room, away from the Oval Office, and back out toward the street. Rule number 18, if you're going to fight the VP, go for broke. James Comey and Jack Goldsmith at the Justice Department told Cheney they could not certify domestic surveillance as legal. He called a meeting to change their minds. The staging had been arranged for maximum impact. Cheney sat at the head of Andy Card's rectangular table, pivoting left to face the acting attorney general. The two men were close enough to touch. "This program," Cheney said, "was vital. Turning it off would leave us blind. It would be a profound mistake. How can you possibly be reversing course on something of this importance after all this time?" Cheney asked. Comey held his ground. "I will accept for purposes of discussion that it is as valuable as you say it is," Comey said. "That only makes this more painful. If I can't find a lawful basis for something, you're telling me you really, really need to do it doesn't help me." "Others see it differently," Cheney said. There was only one of those, really. John Yoo had been out of the picture for nearly a year. It was all Addington. Comey replied, "The analysis is flawed. In fact, facially flawed, lawyer speak for on its face. No lawyer reading that could reasonably rely on it. Gonzalez said nothing. Addington stood by the window over Cheney's shoulder. He had heard a bellyful. Well, I'm a lawyer, and I did, Addington said, glaring at Comey. No good lawyer, Comey said. In for a dime, in for a dollar. Rule number 19, George Bush really is the decider. Bush did not go along with everything Cheney wanted, not by a long shot. But before he could say no to Cheney, he had to find out what the VP was doing. Cheney spent 3 months trying to suppress this Justice Department rebellion. Bush did not find out about that until he called Comey into his private dining room on March 12, 2004. Each of them in that conversation got a huge surprise. Bush's tone grew crisp. I decide what the law is for the executive branch, he said. That's absolutely true, sir, you do, but I decide what the Department of Justice can certify to and can't certify to, Comey replied. Now Bush said something that floored the acting attorney general. I just wish you weren't raising this at the last minute. The last minute. He didn't know. The president said a few more words, not the way it's supposed to work, popping up with news like this, day before a deadline. Wednesday. He didn't know till Wednesday. No wonder he sent Card and Gonzalez to Ashcroft's hospital room. Oh, Mr. President, if you've been told that, you've been very poorly served by your advisors, Comey said. Comey was edging toward a breach of his personal rule against resignation threats. You resign or you don't. He had already decided. The problem, he told friends afterward, was he could no longer assume the president had made an informed decision. This man just needs to know what's about to happen. Comey said, I think you should know that Director Mueller is going to resign today, FBI. Bush raised both eyebrows. He shifted in his chair. He could not hide it or didn't try. He was gobsmacked. Rule number 20. This is almost what Tom Hanks said in that movie, League of Their Own. Rule is, there's no crying in the Situation Room. This story begins when Bush issues an order. There'll be trials at Guantanamo, he says, and they will start by the end of January. Some of the detainees there have been held by now for 2 years. Cheney and Rumsfeld don't like the idea for reasons I could explain later. Here's how they frustrate efforts by Condi Rice to carry out Bush's order. And forgive me, this is a long scene. I think it's worth it. Rumsfeld finally said yes to a meeting on January 29th, 2 days before Bush's deadline. At the appointed hour, Rice took the head of the long mahogany table in the sit room. Cheney usually took the seat to her right, but Rice did not see him today. Along the right side of the table, in black leather swivel chairs, sat Andy Card, John Ashcroft, and George Tenet. To Rice's left were Colin Powell and Air Force General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Between them, looking sheepish, in Rumsfeld's seat, was his deputy, Paul Wolfowitz. Where's the secretary? Rice asked. He's unavailable, Wolfowitz said. Rice picked up her papers. We are not going to have this meeting, she said. We are going to reschedule this for a date in the next week, and the principals will be present. It took 2 weeks. Same room, same cast. Same question, same answer. Rumsfeld was unavailable. Rice marched out and sent a memo, not so much an invitation as a demand. The principals would gather on Wednesday, February 25th, 2004, They were running a full month now behind Bush's deadline. The day arrived. The group filed in. Hadley, Card, Ashcroft, Powell, Tenet, Myers, Wolfowitz. Where's the secretary? Rice demanded. Wolfowitz looked as though he would rather be in that other place, or anywhere. Unavailable, Wolfowitz said. Tenet stood up, pushing back his chair a little harder than strictly required. There are several doors to the Situation Room, and one was just behind him. This is bullshit, he said. I'm out of here. George, do not leave this room, Rice commanded. This is bullshit, Tenet pronounced, more emphatic. He took a couple of steps, and he was gone. Something happened to Rice's face, control melting away. Her eyes welled up, and her next words caught in her throat. The man in the room did not know where to look. "She started to cry," said one of them, and she said, I can't remember the exact words because I was so shaken, something like, "We will talk about this again," and she turned and walked quickly out the door. I'm not walking out, but I'm out of time, and I've barely got through half the rules that one could name about Cheney, so with a little luck, we'll cover some more in Q&A. If you want to know more about me or my book or send an email later, you can go to www.bartongelman.com.